Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 12th of November. Sesame Street went on the air November 10 of 1969, and it is now the longest-running children's show of all time. We're going to talk about Sesame Street this hour. Louise Gicko is an Emmy Award-winning author and composer, and her latest book is a beauty, and it is titled Sesame Street, a celebration of 40 years of life on the street. She is a composer of more than 150 scripts, books, and songs for children and adults, including scripts for Sesame Workshop. She's worked as an editorial director and creative consultant at Jim Henson Productions, created and ran a publishing and multimedia division at Nickelodeon, interviewed cast and crew, writers and directors, and many other people crucial to the creation and production of Sesame Street worldwide, and also spent a season on the set observing and recording everything that went on. I should also tell you, it's my understanding that Cookie Monster is set to be calling into this program today, so you'll have a short window of opportunity, we think at about 9:13 or so, to speak with Cookie Monster. Our phones for you to join this conversation with Louise, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Children's Educational Television, and I'm sure that many of you have memories of, well, you'd have to, 40 years of Sesame Street, you've got memories of special moments on that show. Louise, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're more than welcome, Kathleen. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, yeah, a great pleasure. Isn't it amazing, this idea that somebody had, and to make it a reality when there were so many people who could have said, are you kidding me? No, yeah. No, no. And they didn't.
Yeah, they didn't. It's extraordinary. And it's a real testament to the founder of Sesame Street, Joan Ganz Cooney, and her cohort in this uncriminal enterprise, Lloyd Morissette, who worked for the Carnegie Foundation. Joan was an amazingly convincing proponent of educational television. And the fact that she and Lloyd, I think, came up with the idea was even more extraordinary.
I guess the big question then was, could children learn from television?
Exactly. And no one knew at that time, but Lloyd and Joan both found themselves observing children as they watched television as it existed in 1967 and 1968. I think there's a story that when they first really seriously began discussing the idea, they were at a dinner party, and Lloyd mentioned that he had watched his children looking at test patterns. Of course, you have to be my age, unfortunately, to remember test patterns on
or
television.
Or my age.
They were those sort of funny things that looked like the NBC Peacock and other things that ran when there was no television on. They kept the lines open, and these pictures showed up on television. So on a Sunday morning, if you were a child at home waiting for your first show at, say, 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning, that's all there was to watch, and the kids would sit in front of those test patterns riveted. So Lloyd knew that TV had enormous power, and he and Joan thought, well, what can we do with that power? Can we help kids with it? And Joan herself had noticed that actually at that point kids were learning television commercials. I don't know if you remember things like the Ipana jingle, but kids would sing along with TV commercials, they would learn the messages, and she thought, gosh, if they can learn from television commercials, why can't we create something really substantive that they can learn from?
Yeah, and kids are still singing television commercials.
Yes, they
do remember
actually.
That, don't they? The other question was whether or not there would be a mix-up between fantasy and reality. You've spoken to that. When monsters talk to humans, would that be too much?
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, four pilots were created for a Philadelphia marketplace to test the show initially. And what the educators had decided at that point, that there would be Muppets, there would be animations, there would be all sorts of things off of Sesame Street. But on the actual Sesame Street set, there would only be human beings. And that was because there really was some concern that there would be confusion between reality and illusion in kids' minds if the puppets and humans on the street actually interacted. But what they discovered when they tested the show was that kids' attention spans dropped when they were on the street, which, of course, nobody wanted. And they realized that it was because there were no Muppets on the street. So that's actually when Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch were created, and that's when Bert and Ernie moved to the street and lived there. And it turned out, and I think this is true today, too, that kids are amazingly adept at two things, I think. One is really being able to tell the difference. I think you see that in cartoons. I think you see that when kids look at fantasy and reality. But number two, in certain ways they weren't, but those were good ways, because you could convey messages via the Muppets, which were considered just as legitimate by kids as long as they were honest messages. Kids are a surprisingly discriminating audience.
You write about the whole host of fantastically talented puppeteers who really made this show what it is.
Yeah, they're extraordinary. I sort of handled that in three chapters. There were sort of three waves of puppeteers. The first, of course, include Jim Henson, the amazing Jim Henson and Frank Oz. And then a number of puppeteers, as the show became more and more well-known, and as Jim's work, of course, became more and more well-known, puppeteering became a career for a lot of people whom I think would not have thought of it as such years before. And it's definitely a career that requires a lot of skills. To puppeteer, well, first of all, if you can even imagine being in a Big Bird costume that weighs pounds and pounds and pounds, holding your hand up in the air inside of his head for an enormous amount of time, and roller skating when you actually can't see out the costume, but what you're looking at in order to figure out where you are is a little monitor in Big Bird's chest. Even my saying that fills me full of amazement. So the level of talent and expertise and the difficulties inherent in really convincingly puppeteering on television, or anywhere else for that matter, are extraordinary. And all of these people just, you know, meet those challenges with aplomb and brilliance. And then, of course, there are the characters that you have to create in the midst of all that. You have to be so, that activity has to be so second nature to you, if you will, that you can invest all of yourself in creating these fully fleshed out three-dimensional characters, which every puppeteer does so well. And it's, I think, one of the main reasons for the success of the show is those characters, the relationships they have with one another and with the actors, who are also extraordinary, and the relationships that develop between the audience on the other side of the screen and the characters.
You write about how some of those characters find their voices, which I found really interesting. If you would please tell the story of how Oscar found a voice.
Well, Oscar actually found his voice because of a husky cab driver. But Carol, I think the interesting thing about Oscar is Big Bird is a child. Big Bird is a very young, he's 6 years old, he's very sweet, he's a preschool goer, or an early grade school goer, actually. But Oscar was an interesting conundrum, because his lovely grouchiness, which is sort of the opposite of Big Bird, and to some extent the opposite of Carol Spinney as well, was initially questioned by educators, his whole character, when they began to develop him. They were afraid he'd be too negative. But what they determined, what the educators determined, which I think is extremely interesting, is that Oscar gives kids an opportunity to express themselves, to express real feelings, to feel grouchy if they need to. And, you know, you and I know that kids feel grouchy, adults feel grouchy. There are all sorts of, you know, reasons for us all to be a little grouchy, sometimes these days more than others. And it's extremely important for kids to be able to express themselves in that way. So Oscar developed as a character who could really embody that ability of children to really be honest about their feelings.
We're talking about Sesame Street celebrating its 40th anniversary this week. Hard to believe, huh? Louise Gitko is with us, and she's the author of an absolutely beautiful book, Sesame Street, which includes a DVD with the very first episode. And we're going to be welcoming phone calls for her and also for Cookie Monster. I must tell you that Cookie Monster is with us just right now. So if you'd like to speak with Cookie Monster, it's a short window of opportunity for you to do so. Our phone number is 800-486-8655 for you to join the conversation. Hello, Cookie Monster.
Hiya.
Hi, Cookie Monster. Are you 40 years old too?
Well, you know, it's all different with monsters. We not have the same, you know, ages as people. It's all different. It's like dogs.
It's like dogs.
You know, but it's even different than that. It involves higher levels of math to figure it out. Me really not sure how it works.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So in other words, you're rather ageless, right?
Monsters don't keep track of age. Yeah.
Right. I was wondering, Cookie Monster, this is a long run for the program. What have you learned from being on Sesame Street?
Oh, me learned so much. Me learned, you know, me letters, me numbers. Me learned all about nature, science, of course, cookies.
Cookies.
But, you know, but me learned so much.
Yeah. You. And your favorite letter, I am sure, unless you're going to surprise me, would be C. Is that right?
How do you know that?
I don't know. I just thought probably it's C.
It's C for cookie.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cookie Monster, do you have any friends?
Oh, what you think? Of course we have friends.
You have a lot of friends?
Lots of friends. Yeah. All my friends on Sesame Street, Elmo and Grover, Ernie Bert, Big Bird. We could go on and on. They're all my friends, yeah.
You have been, I don't want to bring up anything too negative, but you have been accused, Cookie Monster, of having a one-track mind, a cookie kind of mind. Is that a fair...
We love cookies.
I know you do.
We love cookies, yeah.
Yeah. So that would be true, that criticism, and it's been a criticism, but maybe you think that it's not, it shouldn't be a criticism to have a one-track mind.
Well, you know, me love cookies, but me, that's not all me love. Me, you know, me eat all kinds of different foods, but, you know, cookies, me just happen to love cookies, but me eat everything.
Right.
Me, you know, meat, fish, meat, vegetables, fruit.
Yes.
You know, truck.
Yes.
We have canoe.
Canoe?
Me, sure, me monster, me not picky. Monsters eat everything.
Yeah, I see what
me
you're saying.
Table.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you mind taking a couple phone calls? We have people who've been waiting to speak with you.
Sure.
All right.
Why not bring them on?
Thank you. Let's go to Jack from Superior. Hello, Jack.
Hey, hi, Cookie Monster. How many cookies have you eaten in your life?
What's the question?
How many cookies have you eaten in your life?
Oh, boy. Me have no idea. It may not count cookies, but me sure it it's a lot of cookies. Yeah, me not exactly sure the number.
It's a lot of cookies.
You know, me not sure. Maybe the count knows.
Huh.
He might be keeping track. Yeah.
Tony from Green Bay. Hi. Tony, are you there? Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to say hello to Cookie Monster and tell him thank you for being my favorite Muppet. You're up against some fierce competition, but you won out in the end.
And, thank you.
There are a lot of great Muppets on the show. And I wanted to let you know I'm 25 years old, but C is for Cookie lives on my iPod in a little folder to be played, you know, whenever I'm feeling a little mellow or a little down during the day. And it picks me right back up. So thank you for recording one of the best songs known to man.
Oh, Tony.
Oh, that's so nice, dear. Thank you for calling.
Oh, that must have made your day, Cookie Monster, didn't it?
Terrific.
Yeah, it did. Lucy from Milwaukee. Hi, Lucy.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Cookie Monster. I just wanted to call and say thank you. I've had Sesame Street on my voicemail at work this week so people can celebrate the 40th anniversary. I was 10 when it came on, and we felt like we were too old to watch it. But it was too cool not to watch. We loved it.
Wow.
We were all watching it and singing it, and we still sing the Rolling O song.
Wow. That's way back.
Way back.
Thank you.
Way back machine. So thank you for being
for
on
calling.
Here this morning.
Thanks
for
so much for your call. Bruce from Oshkosh. Hi, Bruce.
My son Bryce has a question for the Cookie Monster.
Okay. Hi, Bryce. Hi, Bryce. Go right ahead.
What's your favorite cookie?
Oh, now this me kind of question. Yeah. Way to go, Bryce. Okay, my favorite cookie, chocolate chippy.
Ooh.
I love chocolate chippy. Yeah. That classic cookie. I love it. That
thank you for being a good Sesame Street character.
Oh, well, thank you for calling and asking terrific question, Bryce.
Thank you, Bryce, very much.
Bye-bye.
And do you have a special kind of cookie, Cookie Monster, that you're going to be eating this week to celebrate the 40th birthday?
Well, me, of course, have many important cookies, but me have anniversary cookie. Yeah.
Anniversary.
It's gigantic cookie. It has 40 chocolate chippies in it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That sounds delicious.
It's terrific.
Yeah. Well, happy anniversary, Cookie Monster. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, we're talking about Sesame Street celebrating its 40th anniversary this week, and we're talking with the author of a marvelous book, Sesame Street, that is beautiful pictures and description of how this show came to be and all the important things that it has taught us. So we'll continue
now,
in a moment.
What starts with the letter C? Cookie starts with C. Let's think of other things that starts with C. Who cares about other things? C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. Oh, cookie, cookie, cookie starts with C. Oh, C is for cookie. That's good enough for me.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, rubber ducky, you're the one. You make bath time lots of fun. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of you. Bo, bo, bo-dee-o. Rubber ducky, joy of joys. When I squeeze you, you make noise. Rubber ducky, you're my very best friend, it's true. Oh, every day when I make my way to the tubby, I find a...
Louise Gicko is our guest, and we're talking about Sesame Street. That's my favorite song. Don't you love Rubber Ducky? Oh, and it reminds you of all the times you had the little rubber ducky with your children in the bathtub, and doesn't get much better than that. The music that has been a part of this will stay with us, I would imagine, Louise, for a long, 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 long time.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think there are classic songs. I mean, as that lovely caller said, that really can lift you up, make you feel better. I mean, if Cookie is good enough for Cookie Monster, that song is good enough for me.
It sure is. Tell us about one of the wonderful things about this program, and it started so early, was the makeup of the cast. We have people of all different backgrounds. We have black and white and Hispanic and everything, boys and girls. And now it's a little bit more common in television. In those days, it really wasn't. And I'm wondering if there was controversy about making sure you had this interracial cast.
Well, it's interesting. I think among the creators of the show, there really wasn't controversy at all. But it was certainly an unusual cast makeup to not only cast two African-American actors as leads in the show, but to have them portray a couple. You know, we're used to the Bill Cosby show era and beyond, where it was a perfectly natural thing to have an African-American family on television. But the truth is, in 1969, this was pretty much unheard of. So controversy, possibly, I suppose, in certain parts of the country, but actually, surprisingly little. What was unusual was just getting the idea in the first place and then following through. But then what happened, of course, is when we started that kind of multicultural cast, a lot of other groups jumped into the fray. So I think, for example, when Maria and Luis joined the show 1 or 2 years later, that was in response to a call from the Spanish-speaking community to have Spanish-speaking or Latino cast members. The Street responded immediately, and they sort of went from there.
Mm-hmm. We should talk a little bit about the, I didn't know this story, how Sesame Street was named and all of the other possible names that were on the table.
Oh, Lord. You know, it's so funny. There were so many things crammed into my brain these days. I can't even remember half of them. But I will tell you a little story that was quite adorable about the first tape, basically, that was made of anything Sesame, which starred Kermit the Frog and actually Ralph the Dog, Ralph who never did appear on Sesame Street at all. But was a Muppet at the time who was part of Jim's arsenal. He was on the Jimmy Dean Show and later became a star on the Muppet Show. And Dr. Jerry Lesser, who was the man who really was a principal educational advisor and held the curriculum seminars. And in that little tape, which Joan took around the country in order to sell Sesame Street to all the public television networks, was a fictional, although not so fictional, scene of a whole conference room of Muppet businessmen. And I hope women, I can't remember now whether there were women involved. This was 1969, after all. who were trying to figure out a name for the show. And they came up with things like the Itty Bitty Little Kitty Dirty City Show or something like that. But the truth of the matter is that reality in this case, well, I don't know whether reality copied illusion or illusion imitated art, or reality rather, but it was a very difficult show to name. It had a lot of different elements in it. People kept coming up with names, and nothing really felt right until one of the staffers mentioned Sesame Street, which had lovely alliteration, referred to the sort of magical sense of open sesame.
Yes.
But even that name, people were very concerned because, of course, when you look at the word Sesame Street, S-E-S-A-M-E, people were afraid that kids couldn't pronounce it, that they might look at it and think it said see same or something like that. But I think the truth is that nothing better came along, and they tried it and tested it, and it turned out to work brilliantly. So luckily, it didn't become the itty-bitty, kitty-gritty city.
Oh, yes. So. Yeah, it has the perfect name.
Yeah.
Our number is 800-486-8655. Questions you have about Sesame Street's long, lustrous 40 years on the air, or special episodes that you remember, we'd love to hear from you. Ben from Green Bay, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
I've got a question about Sesame Street and the overall, I guess, drive of the show. Obviously, this is an educational program. You were teaching children, myself included, as a young boy, you know, the alphabet, numbers, simple addition. Was that more of a tool used on behalf of Sesame Street to teach larger life lessons, though? Because it seems like, and maybe I'm just projecting this, but I'm fairly certain, at least, that there's, you know, a deeper level of learning going on by the viewers of your show, and a deeper level of teaching going on by, you know, the producers of Sesame Street.
Oh, absolutely.
A little bit?
Yeah, no, it's very smart of you to pick that up, and of course there is. But I will say that the numbers and letters were not a tool. They were part of a curriculum, but the curriculum actually extended way beyond that. In the kids' television business, we talk about something called affective curriculum, which really involves behavior. And I think Sesame Street was originally created to really cover both academic curriculum for the preschool audience, the young audience, and also affective curriculum, because both were extremely important. So, but both were equally important. One wasn't there to mask the other, and the other was there quite, you know, obviously and definitely. And the curriculum, like letters and numbers, for example, also included other academic aspects of language and all sorts of things. There was a science curriculum, things like relational concepts, for example, over, under, around, through. There was a whole academic curriculum that had been created that was very carefully researched and worked so that it was stuff that you could actually effectively teach on television. But that other half of the curriculum really did involve all sorts of things, dealing with feelings of all sorts, relationships between and among people, and Muppets, of course, and a whole lot of other things. So you picked up on a lot of that. And the show also really wasn't afraid to react to events and pick up on curriculums that it didn't, you know, was not in the curriculum documents. And, of course, you may remember, I don't know how old you were when Mr. Hooper sadly passed away, but that's a great example of this curriculum being so open that when he did die, the show felt it was extremely important to address that. So they did. You know, it could have been, we always talk about the two Darrens on Bewitched. You can really replace a character on television, and the audience will pretty much go with it, but to replace Mr. Hooper with another actor just seemed wrong. He was so beloved among the cast and crew. He was so beloved in the audience. But, of course, dealing with the death of a character was not something in the original curriculum.
Right. And here's, we do have a clip of Mr. Hooper's death.
Say, where is he? I want to give it to him. I know. He's in the store.
A Big Bird? Huh? He's not in there.
Oh. Then where is he?
Big Bird, don't you remember we told you? Mr. Hooper died. He's dead.
Oh, yeah. I remember. Well, I'll give it to him when he comes back.
Big Bird, Mr. Hooper's not coming back.
Why not?
Big Bird, when people die, they don't come back.
Ever?
No, never.
Why not?
Well, Big Bird, they're dead. They can't come back.
Well, he's gonna come back. Why, who's gonna take care of the store? And who's gonna make my birdseed milkshakes and tell me stories?
Big Bird, I'm gonna take care of the store. Mr. Hooper, he left it to me. And I'll make you your milkshakes and we'll all tell you stories and
sure,
we'll make sure you're okay.
We'll look after you.
Oh.
Oh, my. I feel just like Big Bird, don't you?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary
yes.
thing. I mean, for Sesame to take that topic and have the courage to run with it. And, of course, it's interesting. You know, we think about kids and what their needs are. Kids with grandparents and great-grandparents who pass away, even kids with pets. Again, it wasn't part of the original curriculum, but Sesame Street had the courage to attack it. And it was not easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually very interesting. I mentioned this in the book, and I find it fascinating. The educational department at that point had to be consulted. The head writer who wrote this episode is Norman Stiles, who is just a genius. He was the head writer on the show for 25 years. And the things that they learned in terms of what you can or can't tell a child about someone beloved who has died were really quite amazing and would not have been obvious. And they certainly weren't obvious to me. For example, you can't tell a child Mr. Hooper was sick and he died. And, you know, it took me a second to realize why, and actually Norman explained this to me, because, of course, then every time something gets sick in a child's life or someone, a pet, a parent, that child would be terrified.
Right.
So the level of sensitivity of the curriculum people and the level of collaboration between them and the writers created a show that was honest but was also completely appropriate in the way that you need to handle this kind of behavior. It ended up being, I think, a modeling device for parents for years whenever they had to deal with this very sad subject.
Yes, it is so beautifully done. It's so from the heart, and so it also gives children more credit than we frequently give them.
Yeah, and I think the show in general does.
Oh, yes.
The show never, ever talks down to kids.
Yeah.
Never.
No, oh, that's quite a piece. Thank you, Ben, for your call. We go to Paula from Menominee next. Hi, Paula.
Hello, good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hey, I just wanted to say I have such fond memories of Sesame Street. I was 5 years old when it first started, and it was my only alone time with my mother as the youngest of nine, and she enjoyed it, I think, as much as I did.
Oh, I'm really glad. You know, you point out something that's extremely important to Sesame Street. This is as if it was a pre-written segue, which I find also very interesting, which is that the original show, as sort of conceived by original head writer John Stone and everybody there, really was designed to encourage parents to watch with their kids, which I think is something that many children's television shows still don't do today. And the way that they did that, to a great extent, was humor. But it was humor handled very, very carefully. It's tricky to write. The idea is that if you have humor in for adults that they would, you know, laugh at and enjoy listening to, it can't be humor that would leave a child going, huh, you know, what was that? What's so funny? I don't get it. So that it's really sort of a double layer of humor. You know, if you're making a joke, for example, and Cookie Monster is hosting Monsterpiece Theater, Cookie hosting a formal show in a formal, I think he wore velvet, as a matter of fact, velvet jacket, and, you know, segueing into these wonderful hysterical nursery rhymes and other shows, was hysterical enough to keep a child laughing to begin with. But, of course, that little tiny reference to Monsterpiece Theater made the adult smile, but never made the child feel left out.
Right.
And it's an extraordinary gift to be able to write that way. And I think it's one of the reasons why Sesame Street, one of the principal reasons why it's lasted so long, because it does act, you know, it acted for your mom, it acted for you on both levels, but you never felt left out as a child. And the parents were amused, were taken care of. So, you know, and there's nothing better, really,
clever.
Than doing anything with your kids, including watching television.
Right.
Thanks so much. I know what I'm getting her for Christmas.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
A perfect present. Thanks, Paula, very much for the call. The other thing that you write about, which ties into what we're saying, is that many of these people, Jim Henson you write about and others, had this great sense of whimsy about them and seemed to be people who were probably the same in their homes, kind of funny, kind of wild, kind of doing silly things all the time, really enjoying life in a wacky kind of way. And they bring that fun and enthusiasm and creativity to the set as well. So they're similar kinds of people wherever
yeah.
they are.
I think that's absolutely true. As a matter of fact, they used to play remarkable practical jokes on one another, as from what I understand, even during the Muppet Show. Frank Oz used to make these incredibly elaborate presents for Jim, these odd, you know, whimsical, crafty kinds of things. And there were some very, very funny things that happened at the Children's Television Workshop at that point, now Sesame Workshop. I'll tell you one story that was in the book. Chris Cerf, who was a very close friend and an extraordinary writer and composer, he created a lot of the classic rock and roll songs on the show, including Letter B, had a very funny idea with a number of colleagues of his one day that involved licensing, which was to fake the creation of a kielbasa sausage license. And you can imagine how many people had to get into the act when I tell you that they packaged kielbasa sausage with a picture of Cookie Monster. They created the labels, they did the art, they did the printing. They packaged them and basically sent correspondence to Joan thanking her for allowing them to do this kielbasa sausage license. Which, of course, people found this in the... I think somebody found it from PR or something in the refrigerator one day and brought it to Joan's attention in horror because they completely believed it. And it wasn't until they hired a marching band doing polka music that traveled to Joan's office one day to admit the fact that it was not really kielbasa sausage, I think, that she actually realized that it was a joke. And it's a tribute to her sense of humor that she laughed and didn't fire everyone. But there was a lot of stuff that went on set and off that really embodied this sense of fun and whimsy and lightness, and you do see it on the screen. I think you're absolutely right.
Oh, those are great stories. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. This week, as you know, we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of Sesame Street. Thank God for Sesame Street, one of the few absolutely brilliant productions that means so much to people who have been watching over the last 40 years. Louise Gicko is our guest. She's an Emmy Award-winning author and composer of more than 150 scripts, books, and songs for children and adults, including scripts for Sesame Workshop. And she has compiled a beautiful book, Sesame Street, which includes songs and the very first episode, plus special bonus footage. It's the whole creation of Sesame Street with beautiful photographs of all the people involved and, of course, all of the characters, human and otherwise. We'll take more of your phone calls in a moment. I do want to tell you as well that I kind of like this Facebook thing. I've only been on it for a couple months, but it's all right. And we are on Facebook now. It seems to be catching on. If you go to www.wpr.org/Kathleen Dunn, then you can sign up and you for our link, and then you can become a friend. But we'd love to have you share some of your favorite Sesame Street memories, and it would be fun for you to do that today. Thank you very much. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, I love trash. Anything dirty or dingy or dusty. Anything ragged or rotten or rusty. Yes, I love trash. It's some more rotten stuff.
Okay.
I have here some newspaper 13 months old. I've wrapped this inside it. It's smelly and old. But I wouldn't trade it for a big pot of gold. I love it because it's trash. Yeah.
Oscar the Grouch, who loves trash. We go back to phone calls now as we celebrate the 40th anniversary of Sesame Street. Laura from Arpin. Hi, Laura.
That's right. Kathleen, I am so unbelievably jealous of you right now. I think that I could take this entire show and just talk and talk and talk.
I know. I'm having so much fun. I feel like dancing, but I can't because I got the microphone here. I got to talk into it.
I have three young kids. I'm 35, and I grew up watching Sesame Street, and I still love it. But I've got three young kids, and I was talking to my son's four-year-old kindergarten teacher, and she said that it's unbelievable how few kids in the class now know Sesame Street, and she attributes it to all of the different kids' networks on satellite TV. So I was wondering about how the ratings for Sesame Street have changed with the advent of all of those different Noggin and whatever other channels there are. And before you answer, I have to tell you that we don't have satellite. Sesame Street is the one show that I trust absolutely with my kids, and we're really strict with what they get to watch. But Sesame Street is just incredible, and I trust it wholly. So.
Oh, that's an important statement.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that so much. You're right, though. It's interesting. When Sesame Street first began in 1969, there were some children's shows on the air. Certainly, you won't remember. You're far younger than I, but Captain Kangaroo is a classic example. But actually, partly because of Sesame Street, because Sesame Street just changed the children's television landscape entirely, you know, the good news and bad news, I guess, is that there's a lot more children's television out there. And, of course, that began with network television on Saturday and Sunday mornings and has evolved, as you say, with satellite and cable television networks like Nickelodeon and the Disney Channel networks. I am happy to say that Sesame Street still, in terms of rankings, of ratings, ranks in the top 10 shows on television and certainly ranks high up in the PBS network. But there's certainly a lot of competition, and it is reflected in the amount of production that Sesame Street gets to do. When they began, we were doing over 150 shows a year. Now, of course, we do 26 weeks of shows, and it's sad, although I will say that over 150 shows in a year was an extraordinarily hard work, so it was very difficult to do. I'm sure everybody was exhausted after the end of it, so it's a little bit easier to produce. But certainly there is more competition now out there, mm-hmm. and some of it is very good stuff.
Right. But her comment is so important, and to have this true for so many years, a television show that not only do parents trust, but they think that it's of such high quality that they expect their children to learn from it as well.
Yeah, and I think it's a tribute to Sesame Street. One of the important things about the show is that, you know, it began, Joan Ganz Cooney called it an experimental television, and it began as an experiment, and it continues to experiment. And as such, it's really evolved over the years. The show has changed just as audiences have changed. I think it's interesting, Dr. Rosemarie Truglio, who is the Vice President of Education at Sesame Street, and I had a very interesting conversation about this and how kids' audiences have changed along with the proliferation of children's TV. And one of the things that she said, which I found very interesting and actually saw in my own daughter, was that the advent of home video really changed children's television audiences, because before home video, I think Sesame Street was just about the only really truly trusted brand out there in the landscape of the box, if you will, of just TV. But when home video came along, parents of young children and even younger children that would allow them to watch television, I think felt more comfortable setting their kids in front of videos that they could control, that had no commercial interruptions, not that Sesame Street ever did, but other shows did, that they could preview. Sometimes, in the case of Disney films, that they had previewed, if you will, when they were kids as well. And as parents felt that they had more control over the medium of TV, not broadcast television, but the actual box, I think they felt more comfortable putting younger children in front of television. And what has happened as a result of that is there's this whole new, well, it's not so new anymore, but there is now preschool television, and kids as young as two or three are watching television. And Sesame Street, of course, has had an extraordinarily vibrant educational and research group all along. And as they test, they've needed to modify the material that they put on television to adapt to this slightly younger audience. So the show is really extraordinary in both reacting, as I said before, to events of the day, like Mr. Hooper. They reacted, of course, to horrific events like 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina by putting special programming on the air. It was actually programming because they needed to react very quickly that had been created not for those specific reasons, but that dealt with, actually it was a huge hurricane destroying Big Bird's nest initially in the case of 9/11, and I think that was rebroadcast to help kids deal with issues like that. But they've also remained flexible in terms of how to structure the show, how to change curriculum, add to the curriculum, as the audience and the world has changed.
Right. Thanks, Laura, for the call. Kathleen from Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good. My question is, they did such a phenomenal job, you know, at the development of the show with, you know, different races and gender and you know, inclusivity in the humans. Mm-hmm. They didn't in the Muppets. I mean, they're all male, you know, they're all male characters. And I wondered how that's affected, you know, girls, you know, Oscar and Cookie Monster and Grover and Bert and Ernie and Big Bird and just to comment on that, I guess.
Yeah, but remember Prairie Dawn and Zoe and Mrs. Stuffleupagus and Abby Kadabi and I do take your point. I mean, it was very true that at the beginning of the show, the first performers of Muppets were actually all men. And Jim used to say, as a matter of fact, that part of the reason for that is to perform a Muppet, you basically have to stand with your arm over your head, and the Muppet fits over that arm, right or left, you know, depending upon, and actually you use both hands for that. But initially, there were four or five tall men of the same height, which made it very easy to work on the same level and made it more comfortable. And then Fran Brill, who's the extraordinary puppeteer who created Prairie Dawn and then Zoe, came on board, and she was the first female puppeteer. And now, actually, there are probably as many women puppeteers as men. There are a lot of subsidiary characters. Well, Grungetta is an example of Oscar's. I don't want to call her Lady Love because he might get annoyed with me. Love is not a word you use in the same breath with Oscar, but there are quite a few women. But it is true that some of the biggest and most important characters are male. The truth of the matter is it's not for want of trying. There are constantly female characters who are developed on the street. A lot of it just depends on what takes off. And you know, it breaks my heart to say this. There's sort of a maxim in television, which we really try to break constantly, and which the workshop is actually, I think, breaking through right now with Abby Cadabby. I don't know if you've at all watched the show lately, but she's a wonderful fairy in training character who they've introduced a couple of years ago, who's really becoming incredibly popular and is holding her own with Elmo and Big Bird. But initially, television networks always used to feel that boys would watch boy characters and girls would watch boy characters, but boys were not as interested in female characters. And I think, you know, in children's television in general, there tends to be a preponderance of male characters. We fight it. We fight it on a regular basis. It's a very difficult situation, and your point is well taken.
Yeah, and it also must be difficult to introduce new characters. You have such a long history now that we're familiar with the characters who tend to be male because they've been around 40 years, right?
Yeah, you need extraordinarily talented puppeteers. Leslie Carrera-Rudolph is one of them who does Abby, and very powerful characters. I mean, the truth of the matter is it's difficult to introduce any breakthrough character, even when you go back to look at Elmo. Elmo was a Muppet who had been created sort of as a background character, and a number of puppeteers tried him, Richard Hunt, I think, being the last one before Kevin Clash, the brilliant Kevin Clash, took him over. And you need an amazing performance, male or female, to sort of break through. But they have them. They have some extraordinary characters and extraordinary performers. And the show does continue to look at developing more and more female characters as time goes by.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this hour, as we celebrate Sesame Street's 40th, can you believe it's 40 years old, Louise Gicko. She's written a beautiful book, Sesame Street, and it looks at, as pictures from the very first broadcast all the way through until now, the famous people who have been on it, how it got its name, what the philosophy is, how it was brought to public television, etc. We're welcoming phone calls for her, 800-486-8655. More calls, but first, this little interlude from Grover.
First, this is near. Right here, near. Mm-hmm. This is near. You see?
Thank you, Grover. We go to Bernard from Presque Isle. Hi, Bernard.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm calling because you need to know that my three oldest kids are all just turning 40 and 45, and they watch Sesame Street all the way through. I have a daughter who's a bass drummer in a marching band in Merrill. She's 16. She's watched it. My son is 7. He's been watching it. So I've been watching every...
I guess you have.
Yes.
You're a Sesame Street family.
I have a question for Louise. In all these characters, and I'm very connected because one of my high school classmates, I think, married Jim Henson. Her name was Beverly way back when, before the unfortunate, much too soon death of him. There have never been any characters that I recall who are either mice or squirrels.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? Because my other phone rang.
There haven't been any characters who are mice or squirrels.
Oh, mice or squirrels. How interesting. You know something? Squirrels, I think you may be right. Mice, I'm not sure. But that may well be correct. And partly, possibly, because, of course, there's a very famous mouse out there, so... to compete with Mickey, it might have been deliberately decided. The other thing about mice is it's difficult to perform a puppet mouse because they're so small, of course. Squirrels, I don't know why. But you know something? Now that we said mice and squirrels, I would not at all be surprised if the people at the workshop start to build mice and squirrel puppets.
Thanks, Bernard, for the call. The other thing we fail to talk about, maybe because it seems obvious to me now, but there was a great deal of discussion about where to put Sesame Street, and I just think it's wonderful that it was put right smack, you know, in Central City, gritty kind of area, but a lot of people felt that shouldn't be the case.
Yeah, well, Sesame Street initially, of course, when we were looking at curriculum back in 1969, and by the way, I apologize to everyone out there. I say we because I identify so strongly with the company, but I wasn't there at the time, so I don't want to take any credit for that. But the show really was looking at all sorts of places to put itself, and one of the audiences that the show really wanted to address, Joan felt it was incredibly important, were inner-city kids who were more disadvantaged at that point. We still have extreme overcrowding in a lot of inner-city schools, and that population was really one that Joan wanted to make sure to serve. And actually, one of the ironies of the show was it ended up serving everyone, which, of course, no one minded. But you know, it sort of was a surprise to everyone. I don't think anyone really expected that every child who watched it would fall in love with it. But in the interest of serving that population, that more disadvantaged population, John Stone, who was, oh my gosh, he had so many titles, he really, in many ways, is the father of Sesame Street, along with Jim. Maybe they're co-parenting of Sesame Street. He was an original producer, director. He became the executive producer for a very long time, was an incredibly talented writer, really fought very hard to put the street in an urban environment. And, in fact, there were alternatives. One of the very strong ones was to actually have the show set in a more fantasy environment. And when you think about it initially, a show that has people and puppets and animation, there's nothing wrong with fantasy, but John really wanted to ground the show in reality. He wanted those kids who lived in that kind of environment to be able to relate to the show itself, to be able to feel comfortable and at home there. And, of course, the other nice thing about an urban environment is it's so diverse in terms of populations of characters.
Right.
You'll see every color of the rainbow of person. You may not see any furry creatures. Well, you might see one or two furry creatures, actually, in urban environments, but you certainly see a wide diversity of people, which is also incredibly important to the show, so I think it was a perfect setting for it.
Oh, I agree. Dick from Waukesha, hi.
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 I heard the discussion of what to call the show. They kicked this around, the itty-bitty something or other. But I didn't hear any. What's the significance of Sesame?
That's an interesting question. You know, part of the significance of Sesame is actually lost to history, but I think that the closest association we could come is the idea of Open Sesame, which was sort of opening kids up to this magical new world of education and excitement, and it had that feeling of sort of Aladdin's Cave of Wonders. Partly, I think, because of the richness and diversity of offerings on the show, all the different animations, all the different live-action pieces, it really did feel like a sort of treasure trove of jewels. And so I like to think, at any rate, that it was that sort of Open Sesame aspect that originally inspired the staffer to come up with that idea. And then, of course, you have alliteration, which is always useful, Sesame Street, the two S's, so that sounded good. And that's pretty much, I think, what anyone can guess at this point about it.
Yeah. Thanks, Dick. Carol from Viroqua. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that in the 60s, the counterculture was very into Sesame Street. We used to get up on Saturday mornings and watch it. It was very clever and very entertaining.
Well, actually, I think one of the things that Jim did was create extraordinary films using the images of the day. You probably remember Pinball Numbers and a whole lot of other things that really borrowed from all the incredible art and design that the counterculture brought to life at that point. You know, I'm thinking back on things like Peter Max and those incredible colors of London fashion and design. And Jim, as a filmmaker and an incredibly visual person, he had unbelievable visual gifts, really took all of that richness of imagery that the counterculture sort of helped bring to the fore and created pieces that artistically reflected that. Plus, the other thing about it was that the music reflected all the different styles of music that were around at that time, everything from 50s rock and roll to more of the 60s sort of psychedelic music to classic tunes that, you know, Joe Raposo created. So the whole feel of it really benefited, I think, from the richness of imagery and sound at the time.
Yeah, it sure did. Louise, you've been an absolute delight. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And thanks
for
the book.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Louise Gickow, and she is the author of a marvelous book on Sesame Street, celebrating their 40th anniversary this week. Sesame Street is the name of it. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for great production. This has been fun. John Treader for on-air production. And thanks to Cookie Monster as well. And thanks for calling. And for listening, this is the Ideas Network.